Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Colavita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
There we go. I should know that. So I come in when that big when the big snare drum gets hit. I think that's what that sound is. Hey, welcome back to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk here on Heritage Radio Network. All you listeners out there in internet streaming land, Stitcher, iTunes, thanks for supporting Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening to the show. We got a nice little blurb somebody sent me the other day, an eater. Hey, eaters paying attention to Heritage Radio Network. That's a good thing. The more ears we get, the better it is for everybody. We've got a good show today. We have three different sets of guests, if I can call them sets, if one of them is singular or two of them are singular. We're going to talk to Susan Reed up in Vermont. She is the head baker researcher guru at King Arthur Flour about Easter baking, spring baking, baking in general. She's great. I used to have her on my TV show when I could get away with that. Can't do that anymore, but I still talk to her all the time. And they're one of the great resources for baking. So we're going to talk to her about what's up and about things like, oh, I took some notes. Was it babka? I don't know. I've got notes here somewhere. I'll find it. Hot cross buns, I think, was one of them. And then we've got the guys from Chipotle Grill, which I guess you guys, you know, Chipotle Grill is sort of one of these newfangled chain restaurants. Can I call them that? Can I call it fast food? Is that fair? Is that unfair? I think that's what they are. I've never been to one. So I have, in the interest of full disclosure, I live in Cape May, New Jersey for the summer and the weekends, and I cook down there all the time. And when I'm in Manhattan, I'm pretty much out to eat, and I'm not eating at Chipotle Grill. But having said that, they have just launched a new Hulu series of four mini, I think it's like 20-minute long. They're pretty hysterical. I watched one of them. I didn't have time to watch all four, but I watched one of them, and I'll tell you what, they kick ass. They look just like great TV. Super high production value, super well edited, and it's kind of like railing against big agri. It's funny. They've really, I'll have them talk about it, but I really, the first one I watched, I was really impressed with. They've got some kind of big name actors and actresses in it. It's shot the way you would shoot real high-budget TV, and it really does kind of shit on big farming and big agra in a funny way, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I liked it. So we're going to talk about them, how they even got into this thing. I'm curious. It's a funny time, because I don't know if, and you know, you guys are out there listening to this, you must be in the food world. The people at Vice, that great snarky, started as a magazine a long time ago, the people at Vice are getting kind of big. They had that Munchies thing on the internet for a while, but that was kind of like stoner TV. Hey, we have to get King Arthur on the phone, right? Sorry, let me know when she's on. Sorry about that. I shouldn't say that on radio, but this is a nice thing about internet radios. I can do that. WOR, they'd make faces, but I would signal to my engineer, like, or something. Anyway, Vice TV. They had Munchies, which I used to watch once in a while, but Munchies was just kind of like stoner stuff, wasn't it? I mean, wasn't it the whole point of it? Like, who were they hanging out with? And what was that puff of smoke coming in from the corner of the screen? It was funny, and it was kind of backstage glimpses of late night New York. And then they had that show with Eddie Wong, which I'm not sure was a food show. But now they're really getting into, they partnered with Fremantle Media, and they're really getting into food in a more serious way. And I'm curious to see what they do, because I'm a big fan of Vice in general. I like the magazine. I like their embedded journalism. You know, they're working with HBO now. And to see them getting into food is going to be really interesting, because they're going to be sort of talking to that mystery audience, guys basically 18 to 35 that no one can seem to reach. So keep an eye on that. And then after, at the bottom of the hour, I've got the guy, two of the three-man team that run, well, it's more than three people, but let's say the top three, two of the top three honchos from a restaurant in Williamsburg called Maison Premier that I really, really like. In the crowded field of Brooklyn restaurants, I think they rise above most of the competition for a couple of reasons. I'll get into that when I have them with me on microphone. But, you know, the whole Brooklyn thing's funny. The word Brooklyn's just taken on this international appeal. Like in France, there's a there's an expression, it's Trey Brooklyn, which means like everything cool. Like you can't be cooler than that. It's Trey Brooklyn. Ooh, wow. You know, I've lived in Manhattan for most of my adult life, moved to New York City in 82, and I've been on the island of Manhattan since then. That's a nice long run. And I remember when Brooklyn was kind of the bridge and tunnel crowd people that came to New York on weekends that we all laughed at. Well, no one's laughing anymore. The restaurant scene has moved in a huge way to parts of Brooklyn, probably starting with Carroll Gardens years ago for rent reasons, and for many years after that for rent reasons. Williamsburg opened up, and then Bushwick opened up, and Parks, just et cetera, et cetera. A lot of New Yorkers, a lot of Manhattanites left because Brooklyn was more affordable, and now there's this movement. I'm calling it the Church of Brooklyn, where the Brooklynites who are sort of devout and steadfast don't even come into Manhattan anymore. They don't, why bother crossing the East River? And it really is kind of evangelical and exclusive and proselytizing. And to me, it's a little bit off-putting, but it's typical of like a young restaurant movement or a young anything movement. It's just young. It's young. It's like a teenage restaurant movement full of sort of zealous converts who own it. It's their story. They're exuberant. However, to my experience, too many of the places that I go to have one failing, that is they seem to be put together by a chef or a couple of chefs who found a backer or a couple of backers, found a space, built it out, and thought if we cook interesting food, they'll come, and they've forgotten something called front of the house. So if I go to one more Brooklyn restaurant where you're welcome, sort of like somebody rolling their eyes and looking at you and pointing to a chair, maybe throwing a menu on the table where there's probably breadcrumbs from the person that was there before you, just that sort of thing. There's like the service sucks because chefs just don't get service, you know. You kind of need front of the house people. Well, that's why Maison Premier's here. So we'll talk about that with them. But again, the Church of Brooklyn. Yes, I'm going to dub this term, and I'm going to march on that one. It's new, and it's here, and it's now. And I'm looking forward for it to grow up. Do we have Susan on the line by chance? Hey, Susan Reed, can you hear me?
I certainly can.
Were you listening to that whole rant?
Yes, I was.
Sorry, Susan. Because you're up in Vermont. You're like, Michael, come on. Hey, how's the winter been up by you, huh?
Spectacular.
Do you ski at least?
Yeah, actually.
So it is spectacular. So you don't care. You like it.
Yeah. It's the snowbanks are getting high enough that it's hard to see around them.
Yeah, well, that's a problem a few years ago they would have loved to have had. There was one winter about 5 or 6 years ago. It snowed so much down in Cape May where I had to travel. I think I was doing radio then. I had to drive back and forth every week. And you had no snow in Vermont. And we had like, yeah, we had like 6 feet of snow. It looked like the Arctic wonderland for about eight to nine weeks that winter. Power went out a couple of times for days at a time. It was nasty. Anyway, so Susan Reed, I to get your title right, you are the head baker. What's your title?
I'm a chef. I write the magazine.
The baking sheet.
I think I'm going to change my title, but nothing really applies to what I do except for everything.
So we should talk about
I bake, I write, I teach.
And that's all you do. And you've been doing that forever. And you're great at all of it. I've seen you. I used to have you on TV when I could get away with that stuff because you were great. You really bore down on stuff. And I kind of shy away from baking because it's kind of the other half of the brain. And although you have told me that pie dough is easy, I don't believe it. But you make it look easy. So let's talk about some stuff. Let's talk about, we have Easter coming up, and I'll talk about hot cross buns. How the hell do you make hot cross buns?
It's a sweet yeast dough. So if you take flour, water, salt, and yeast, you can make bread. And that's what that crunchy baguette and good artisan bread that I'm sure you can find at the Church of Brooklyn.
all over, actually. There's
Yen Kuit
is a great bakery in Brooklyn.
You know, that speaks well to actually a renaissance in American food, that in the last 20 years you can actually get really good bread.
Yep.
And a lot of places. And even in the grocery store, they're baking decent bread. So that part is good. Sweet yeast breads, the minute you add things like sugar and eggs and butter to those other four ingredients, the texture of what you get changes. It becomes more tender, it becomes a little tastier. And there's a long Easter tradition of basically using up all that good stuff before Lent, or as you're coming out of Lent.
Oh, that's true. See, as a lapsed Catholic, I forgot that give things up. You're supposed to give things up for Lent.
Yes.
So practicing Catholics do that. You're right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And it's reflected in the way that the bread is made all over, like there's Colomba Pasquale, there's Sarecki, hot cross buns are supposedly only available during Lent. And they're kind of a cheat, though, because they've got all these other extra goodies in there, like nice dried fruit, and, you know, it's a nice tender yeast bread. I grew up on the things, and I'm absolutely in love with them. Good ones are really yummy treats. So it's basically a dinner roll that is basically all tricked out.
And it even has that. What is the white icing that makes the cross on the top of hot cross buns?
It's
is that
usually,
like 10x sugar and water?
Well, it depends on where you are, but usually there's a light glaze that gets brushed over it, and then it can be anything from fondant, which is basically invert sugar frosting, or you can use a confectioner sugar frosting. Either one is fine. And they have a little vanilla, you know, in there for just for fun and tastiness. But yeah, I used to smear that all over the top of it, so every little bit would get some frosting and. Yeah,
when they're warm, they're kind of like irresistible.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about babka. How would you describe babka as it falls into the lexicon of baked goods?
Well, babka is kind of, it can be almost like a pound cake, and it can be almost, and it, or it can be more bread-like. Babka's got lots of different things going on. It's rich, and it usually has some rum going on in it, and it's a Polish tradition. I've seen filled babkas that have chocolate filling where you make it into like a twist. So it was, I love all these breads because they're really a chance for bakers to throw down. I mean, if you see a paska that's like a braided thing that looks like a big old crown with decorations on the top, and the Greeks have their soreki, which have the dyed Easter eggs in it.
Italians do that stuff. They've got those breads, too, with, like, hard-boiled eggs stuck in the middle.
Yeah, it's kind of funky, but yes.
Yeah, I grew
so
up
what
with
you
that
should
stuff.
Do is dye the eggs when they're raw, and then when you put them into the braid and bake it, then the eggs cook with the bread.
And this is all part of that Easter tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, eggs are always the sign of, that's the food code, actually, for rebirth and
yes.
renewal.
Yes.
Obviously, an egg starts, you know, new life, so...
Right.
Part of the reason it's in all that.
And so, and babka's roots are Polish?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I know that yep. There's a great store in New York that's like, I think it's in its fourth or fifth generation now called Russ and Daughters. It's an old appetizing store that specializes in smoked fish, caviar, and herring. Its roots actually go back to southern Poland. And Russ and Daughters is now in the great hands of the two heir apparent kids, Nikki and Josh, who are just young, I guess in their 30s, young kids who are going to take it over. They own the families own the building, and they've got ridiculously good chocolate babka in there. It's impossible to resist.
Yum.
What's in the baking sheet next month?
Well, we're about to come out with early spring, and it's, what the heck if I just sent it to the printer, so I don't have it in front of me. Hang on a second, I'll have to look it up.
Yeah,
what do we put in there? Rhubarb, it's time for rhubarb and strawberries. And...
I can't wait for rhubarb. This has been this winter in New York City has been absolute garbage. Actually, even in Cape May, it stunk. We had those Arctic infarctions or whatever they were called. It just got really horribly cold, and we've had snow. We still have snow on the ground in New York on, like, the north-facing sides of the street that's been there 6 weeks, 2 months. It doesn't look like snow. It looks like dirty sand dunes or something.
It's disgusting.
And then there's parts. There's still parts of the city where if someone owned a lot that was vacant, no one has shoveled that. So like navigating, I bike around New York pretty much 12 months out of the year. I haven't had this week was the first couple days I had my bike out in months, which is black ice and stuff. You can't see. The streets have been nasty. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to rhubarb, because that's like the beginning of spring coming.
Yeah, we've got some thumbprints. We did an interesting thing just to open it up for a breakfast. You know, Dutch babies?
No, I don't. Dutch babies, is it a pancake?
Yeah, it's like a German, you know, pancake that you put in the oven, the hot oven, it puffs up.
Yes.
Ever had those?
Yes,
very
I have.
Very Midwestern thing, I think. They used to be in the Waffle Houses in Chicago all the time. So we decided to do a savory version of that. So we took, you know, it's butter, flour, eggs, and whatever kind of, you know, meat or cheese garnishes you want to throw in there. And it's basically sort of like an omelet, only you don't have to have any technique. Just put your cast iron skillet in the oven and then mix up your scrambled egg mixture, throw in some garnishes, and have at it. Throw it in the oven, and then there's breakfast or dinner.
So that's going to be in the next baking sheet.
Yep, that's one of the things that's coming up.
I've actually kept, and I don't usually do this stuff. Your baking sheets come out six times a year, five times a year?
Yes.
Six times a year, and they've got little three. They've got those ring holes punched in them, so they go into a notebook like the old days for school. And I'll tell you what, I have your baking sheets going back 5 or 6 years, and recipes that I have used again and again and again, and I still have to go back to them because I can't. Every time I bake, it's a little different. That's why I don't bake much. I'm completely inconsistent. But your recipes are spot on. So how do people find out about the baking sheet? They go to kingarthurflour.com?
Yes, they do. And then just at the bottom of any other of our web page, you'll see Baking Sheet Newsletter, and there's a little preview for it. And we have a digital version. There's an app, which is kind of sexy, because if you decide to go digital, every single issue of the Baking Sheet that goes back to 20-something-odd years, if you're a current subscriber, you've got all of that
in
your hand.
That's nice to know. And you even have an 800 line there where people can call up with baking questions, which I love.
It's true, the Baker's Hotline.
Which
or
is.
You can chat with us online, too.
Seriously?
Yeah.
What's the phone number?
Oh, geez.
Just whatever it is. GoogleKingArthurFlower.com. If you don't have a computer, get one. GoogleKingArthurFlower.com. It's all there. It's crazy. let's get you back on in like 2 months to talk. Because I don't know when spring's. Spring was really late here last year, like a month late. And I'm hoping that's not going to happen this year because winter has been like a torture session. So let's get you back on in the spring to talk about rhubarb and berries and what's coming up next.
Strawberries, yumminess.
Strawberries,
yeah,
yumminess.
When you first see that stuff that's not from South America.
Yes, thanks for coming on. Susan Reed has been my guest. King Arthur Flour, Great Company, America's oldest flour mill. When you go into the high-end restaurants and they can afford the best ingredients, like, say, Per Se, that's whose flour they're baking with. Not surprisingly, Danielle's restaurants, Danielle's whole baking program, uses King Arthur's wholesale flours. That's kind of why I fell in love with you guys years ago. Thanks for coming on the show with me.
Thanks, bud. Stay cool in the pool.
Oh, we talked about that on the, yesterday was an epic one. Let's not. Thanks. Yeah, well,
bye.
Spring's coming. Thank you. Hey, you're listening to Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to have a guest in a couple of minutes because we have to sort of juggle the phones. I had mentioned this in the setup. We're going to talk to Chris Arnold, who is the communications director for Chipotle Grill, which, again, in the interest of full disclosure, I don't know, but I've heard great things. And actually, there was a chef in New York, Nate something or other. Waxman, the guy that opened up Polino's. Nate Appleman, who last I heard was the executive corporate chef. Anyway, Chris Arnold, do I have you on the phone?
I am here.
Thanks for making the time for us, because you're a moving target today. Much appreciated.
Sure.
So, first of all, give us just, if you can, let's assume, I mean, I don't know how much of my little open you heard, but in the interest of full disclosure, I know of Chipotle Grill. I know that you're really popular, that you do really good work, and that you're like sort of the new generation, if you don't mind me saying this, fast food, is that the wrong term? But it's sort of fast food done right. Just give us like the sound bite, one paragraph description of what Chipotle Grill does and what its reason to be is.
Sure. Chipotle is changing the way people think about and eat fast food. And at the core of that is our commitment to finding the best, most sustainable sources for the ingredients that we use, and preparing all of the food we serve using classic cooking techniques, so not uber-industrialized, heavily processed foods. And then we serve all of that food in an interactive format that lets customers pick and choose exactly what and how much goes into their own individual order, which allows us then to meet the tastes and dietary preferences of really virtually anyone.
From the beginning, you were using you have a lot of pork on the menu, and you were using pork sourced from the Neiman Ranch.
We started working with the folks at Neiman Ranch
about
a dozen years ago. We at the time were reworking the recipe for our carnitas, which at the time wasn't selling as well as other things on our menu, and in large part because it wasn't as good. And so Steve Ells, who's our founder and who's a classically trained chef, set about reworking the recipe. And while he was doing that, he read an article in a little food web newsletter called The Art of Eating.
Yeah, sure, Edward
by
Baer.
A guy named Ed Baer,
yep.
who you likely are familiar with, about the farms of Neiman Ranch. And he loved this story, and he cooked with the pork and absolutely loved it, and went and visited Paul Willis on the farm in Iowa to see how the pigs were raised and learn more about that. And what he saw on the Neiman farms was happy pigs on open pastures who were raised without the use of antibiotics. And really liked it. It was sort of this ideal image of what American agriculture is, but that's not really what American agriculture is all of the time.
In fact, no.
Yeah, particularly where pigs are concerned,
yes.
Where 95% or more are are raised in these confinement operations, and Steve visited those as well, and was really horrified by what he saw, and decided then that he didn't want his success or Chipotle's success to be tied to this really exploitative model, and so that really set us on this quest to find better, more sustainable sources for all of the ingredients we use, and now we serve more naturally raised meat, meat from animals that are raised in more humane ways and without the use of antibiotics or added hormones. We do more of that than any restaurant company in the world. We're the only national restaurant company with significant commitments to local and organically grown produce. We're the only one with significant commitments to pasture-raised dairy. We were the first to voluntarily disclose genetically modified ingredients on our menu, and in fact are now in the process of eliminating GMOs from our food.
Yeah, it's a great story, and we're a bit spoiled. I live in Manhattan and at the Jersey Shore at the beach, but I'm in Manhattan a lot, and I get to pick where I shop for meat and for. For the longest time, I've been buying meat from two sources in the city. One's on the west side, Jake Dixon's Farm Stand, which is local New York State, organic grass-fed. Some of it's grain-finished, some of it isn't. But he knows all the farmers. He knows the guys that raise the pigs. He knows the four or five guys that bring him the cattle. And now I live on the Lower East Side, and I've got, in the Essex Street Market, I've got Heritage Meats there, which is the exact same thing. And I will tell you, every chef I talk to, and that's all I do, really, is swim around and talk to chefs all the time. That's my business. The taste of meat from animals that had a happy life, that lived well, that were treated well, that ate well, is absolutely different than commodity stuff. I really can't eat commodity proteins anymore. They just taste like poop to me. Interesting that you guys discovered that, but it makes sense because chefs know that. Did you start in Colorado, or is that a misnomer?
No, we started in Colorado.
That's what I thought.
In fact, you really touched on something as a New Yorker. That's been really important to us for so long. Food made with these better ingredients has been really only available in high-end restaurants or specialty food markets, generally in the bigger cities in the country. And we've really been on this quest to make that better food more widely available. You know, eating great food from great sources should not be something only available to people on the coast.
Correct, certain zip codes
available to everyone.
I agree with you, and I remember when you guys first started, you came on radar, and I was like, "This is a great story," because you started small and you built out. How many stores do you have now, coast to coast?
About 1,600.
Great. All right, so you're here today. So now we have the Chipotle Grills background. Thanks for that, but that's not exactly why you're here today. You have entered this new domain of, I guess, for want of a better term, food television, although you're streaming, but the media, I've been doing PBS for 13 years now, and everything's moving now to on-demand, to handheld, to YouTube, to Hulu, to Vimeo. There's a lot of great new stuff. I mean, what Netflix got was up for 6 Emmys last time I looked. So its broadcast is moving into a lot of different arenas, and you guys have created a series of, is it 4?
It is 4, yes.
What would you call them? Because I just hate misstating things, and I'm not the best at this kind of soundbite. I watched the first one today. I did not watch the last 3, but I watched the first one, and I have to tell you, as a guy that shoots television, edits television, works with cameramen, directs the cameras, it's killer. It looks like fucking great TV. It's just really tight. Whoever shot it was shot beautifully, high def, multiple cameras, on dollies. The edit on the soundtrack was perfect. I've recognized, I'm not going to mention who the actors and actresses are. You can talk about that. But, I mean, you've just stepped up and ramped into this and gone into the deep end. This is really good-looking work.
Well, thank you. And we're certainly pleased with how it came out. We're calling it an original comedy series. And the show is called Farmed and Dangerous. The first episode is available now on Hulu and Hulu Plus. The next 3 will be going up on the next 3 Mondays, one each week. And really the idea here was that by doing many of the things we're doing with food and the decisions we're making in terms of how we run our business, we're in many ways trying to impact upon a set of problems that most people don't know are problems. you're very aware of them. People who really follow food and food issues closely are very aware of them. And I'm talking about problems like the overuse of antibiotics in livestock and the heavy reliance on fossil fuel and large-scale agriculture, the use of GMOs, added hormones in meat and dairy production. And most people, including many of our own customers, don't really know about these issues. They don't necessarily know that we're really trying to drive change in those areas. And so what we're doing with programs like Farmed and Dangerous is trying to create something that is first and foremost entertainment, but within that entertainment designed to make people more curious about food and where their food comes from.
And, you know, it's funny. It's just there's this has all it's lessening now, but there's been this disconnect in America between what consumers are buying and how it's brought to the market or how it gets into the supermarket shelves. Years ago, and I'm talking about like the mid-90s, I remember subscribing to the New Yorker magazine, which tended to even to this day, specialize in these really long-form pieces where they bore down and, you know, that kind of journalism almost doesn't exist anymore outside of places like the New Yorker, excuse me, the New Yorker, not New York magazine. Sure. And I remember taking the New Yorker on a plane with me because that's when I had about 6 hours to read these things. And it was a piece on antibiotics in animal food and antibiotic-resistant bacteria. This was prescient. This was 20-some years ago. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, hell, I'm a chef and I didn't know that. And then, of course, I did the homework. And, yeah, the biggest end user by far of pharmaceuticals in this country are farmers. Not hospitals, not doctors, no. Not medical practitioners, but farmers who are lacing the farm animal feed with the kind of stuff that we've been using exclusively for years to fight the biggest bugs. And the link between that and the sort of the outgrowth of these super bugs is almost unequivocal now.
Almost unequivocal, and both the USDA and FDA are now acknowledging that those links are probably very real. And you're absolutely right. Several times, the quantity of antibiotics used to treat human illness are used in animal agriculture. And to be clear, you know, we don't have any problem with sick animals being treated
right.
with antibiotics.
That's not what we're talking about.
A sick animal would be inhumane.
Right.
But effectively what's happening in really large-scale animal agriculture is that well, I think the analogy is this. If you have children and you send the kids to school and one of them comes home with strep throat, you give them an antibiotic prescribed by a doctor to treat the illness. What you don't do is put antibiotics in with their breakfast cereal every day to keep them from getting sick. Well, this is what's happening in large-scale animal agriculture, and it really doesn't need to be that way. And people have been talking about it for decades, but change has come very, very slowly, and there's a lot more talk of it now. There are a lot of great books over the last several years on issues in food. I've lost count of how many Michael Pollan
has written,
but
sure.
But you know, these things, you know, documentary films like Food Inc. Or now you've got Fed Up that was just released, I believe, at Sundance, and people are talking about. But you know, these things are really helping to make that conversation more mainstream, which is really what we're trying to do with shows like Farmed and Dangerous.
Yeah, they refer to it as the prophylactic use of antibiotics, and for some reason that no one has been able to figure out yet, and this sort of explains, I mean, as farmers are doing this for two reasons. One is the way they raise these animals is really, they're raised in pens and they're fed stuff they're not supposed to eat. Like, cows aren't supposed to eat corn. They
right.
just get fat faster by eating corn, so if you were the Henry Ford production line model of farming, you would see why they're doing what they're doing, because it brings calves to slaughter weight fast and clean.
Right.
The antibiotics are there to prevent them from getting sick, but also there's an added benefit for some reason that they actually gain weight a little bit quicker than animals that aren't raised this way, which no one can figure out why that is.
That's right.
However, there's the downside of it's terrible. Anyway, if you haven't, the name of the show is called what again?
It's called Farmed and Dangerous.
It's funny as hell.
It's available on Hulu and Hulu Plus.
It's hysterical. One of the protagonists is a guy named Buck Marshall. Who's the actor that plays Buck Marshall?
Buck Marshall is played by a guy named Ray Wise, and Ray is one of these actors where you say his name and people say, I don't know who that is.
Yeah, you know his face.
And then you show them a picture and everyone knows who he is. He was Laura Palmer's father in Twin Peaks, and he was the head of Dow Chemical in Mad Men,
right.
And he's been in soap operas, and he's played the devil himself, and he's played vice presidents, but he's been a character actor, a really talented character actor, working for 45 years and been in close to 200 movies and television shows and does just a great job as Buck Marshall, who is in the show kind of the ultimate
You're the ultimate scumbag. No, he's the ultimate scumbag. It's great because, I mean, the opening scene is hysterical. I'm not going to – spoiler alert, I'm not going to give away the story, but it has to do with some genius figured out a way to feed to feed cattle petroleum pellets. Petro pellets,
yep,
they're called. It's hysterical.
Right.
It's hysterical. So Hulu is the network you go to. You know, just go to Hulu.com, and then it's called Farmed and Dangerous. It's brought to you by the people at Chipotle Grill. Thanks for coming on. I look forward to the next three episodes in the three coming weeks, and I got a kick out of the one today. It was hysterical.
Excellent. Well, do keep an eye out for the next one, and hopefully you'll like those as well.
Thanks, and keep up the great work with the company. You guys are doing great work, sort of spreading good food around the country to places where it's not exclusive to zip codes, and a big fan of Chipotle Grill. Even though I'm not a customer, I love what you're doing. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
Hey, stay where you are, folks. This is Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're going to come back in just a couple of minutes with my last two guests to finish out the half hour so we can talk a little slower and take a few breaths in between here. And we're going to talk about the Brooklyn restaurant scene done right, in my opinion, by a team that does a great job. I mean, kind of a north. Is it North Williamsburg? Can I call where you guys are? No. Just Williamsburg? Is it south? See, I should know. It's north for me because I live south of the Williamsburg Bridge.
Yeah.
Is the south side? All right. Okay, so it doesn't matter. So don't ask me about Williamsburg. I don't know. It's the domain of flannel beards and droopy beanies. I'm not invited. But anyways, come back. We're going to have a quick spot for give a shout out to some of the people that make the show possible, and then we'll be back live with my guests.
This is Coyote by Brothers NYC on heritageradionetwork.org.
Suitcase in your hand, got 6 or 7 grand. 5 hours late and still no one.
Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved, used them for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from because I'm always curious with ingredients. What is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots, where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with a 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano. Mike Colomeco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters, and I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about, but a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil and baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Are you afraid what they say, what this man has done?
Folks, welcome back. The headphones are off because now we're in studio. Let me introduce my two guests. Ben Crispin, who... I'm so bad with faces. It's crazy. But when I walked into Maison Premier, you introduced yourself, and I had known you. It just takes me, like, you have no idea how bad I am with faces. There's probably a clinical name for it, which is not going to be, you know, flattering. But yes, you had been the maitre d' and in the front of the house at the Lavanos's.
Yeah.
Oceana restaurants.
Yeah, Oceana for years.
For both restaurants. The old Oceana with the leaky kitchen roof and then the new sparkling, amazing
one. I was a captain at the old one for years and years and years. And then when we opened the new space, I was their dining room manager.
And I really love the Lavanos family.
Me as well.
Great guy. I mean, that's a bootstrap story, which we'll save for another day. But their high-end restaurant was Oceana, where guys like Rick Moonen came through, Cornelius Gallagher. Ben Pollinger's the chef there now. It's just one of the greatest seafood restaurants in the city.
I think
and a great
too.
Dining room. So, and you ended up in Brooklyn. Josh Boise. Boise? Boise?
Boise. Boise, yeah.
Boise, because we're in America, but that's not how it should be pronounced. But that's all right. Give us your backstory, because you told me this once again, and then we're going to get to what you guys did. You were in the restaurant business. Tell me how you ended up.
Yes, I grew up in the restaurant business. Actually, I grew up in New Hampshire. My mother was a single mother, and she ran restaurants and hotels since the earliest I can remember. So after school, my... babysitter was the restaurant. And so I hung it at a very young age, sitting at a banquette, you know, folding napkins or doing my homework and just observing. And that went on for years until I was, you know, not really legally of age to work, but started working on the side at some of the restaurants that she was managing. And from there, I just, you know, followed the path from back of the house through the front of the house. And over the years, I had pretty much worked in every position in the restaurant. And then I left working for the mom-and-pop restaurants and started working for some chain restaurants in hotels and resorts, and we moved to Florida. I continued working in Cape Coral and Fort Myers and Sanibel Island, and then I went on to Miami, and I got a taste of the nightlife on South Beach working in nightclubs. From there, I came to New York City. I worked at Buda Bar in the Meatpacking District, which was a juggernaut, and I learned just a ton about high volume, you know, waiting on heads of states and celebrities and serving dinners that are just in the thousands of dollars that I had, you know, the type of dinner experiences that I had never seen before at the mom and pop operations. And so I took a lot away from those different experiences that I had in Miami and in New York. And I moved to Williamsburg in 2006, and I lived above a failed restaurant. And the failed restaurant was Le Baracu. It opened up and it was going out of business. And I was working in the city at the time with my partner, my now partner, Christoph Ziska, who was my best friend, and we were waiting tables together in the city. And both of us didn't plan on working in the restaurant industry long term and had met working there. And Le Baracu was about to close, and I was offered an opportunity to take it over. And at the time, I didn't have any savings or any knowledge of running a restaurant by myself, but I went for it, and I took over the restaurant. And the day I took it over, they had two employees. I was the front of the house, and we had two cooks in the kitchen. And literally, I was handed the keys by one of the partners there, and I took it over. And it was a very scary yet exhilarating moment for me, being at the time, I think I was 20 years old, just barely 21 years old, taking over a business with no experience running one. And I immediately, you know, put it in fifth gear and started reading about cafes and restaurants and eating at as many French restaurants as I could in the city. And we booked a trip to France, my partner and I, Jean-Pierre, who was the founder of that restaurant. And we just immersed ourselves in what a cafe and bistro was. And so the story of Maison Premier started with Le Barricou, me learning how to run a restaurant, learning how to study and understand what the concept was and the vision. And then from there, we were able to build a business around it, a business model. And then therefore, we were able to turn the business around. And from there, that's where the concept Maison Premier was born. It was through the process of reviving Le Barricou.
It's funny you mentioned France. We last week we were filming, and Keith McNally I've known of forever because Keith opened up Odeon back when I first came to New York. He opened actually in 80. I came to New York in 82. And I lived, my first apartment was in Tribeca, and I just remember Odeon was like, what the fuck? Saturday Night Live guys hanging out there. Chef was Patrick Clark, African American guy that was just cool as can be. Ended up at Tavern on the Green for a while, had his own restaurant. And then after that, he Cafe Luxembourg, uptown on the Upper West Side. Mm-hmm. And then he began with Balthazar and Pastis in the 90s. And who was just able to replicate this. Like, you go into Balthazar or Pastis. Pastis is going to shutter as we speak. But it was a parking garage. And you would, I mean, I've been all over France. You name the famous brasseries and bistros, and I've been to all of them. Mm-hmm. And you go in there, and it's literally like you've stepped off the streets of Manhattan into something that's been there for 120 years. He just creates this bespoke environment. Your restaurant... I mean, his restaurants are big, big. One of some of the top grossing restaurants in the city. Balthazar on a busy day does 1,600 covers. It's insane. Your restaurant has this real charm to it. I remember I was introduced to it by mutual friends, Jordana Rothman and Dan, her
boyfriend. Daniel Krieger.
I had dinner with him last night, yeah.
Photographer, great guy. I mean, I love him. That's a whole different generation. I'm not on Instagram, but he's huge. He's a great food photographer, wedding photographer. I know him from the food world. And they introduced me to your place, and I had seen pictures because Jordana, they would post up, this is where we are, the garden. It's just beautiful. Now, was it New Orleans inspired? What was the inspiration? Because you walk in, there's a horseshoe. I actually jogged past it. Because that's part of my – I'll come over the Williamsburg Bridge, make a left-hand turn on whatever that street is, take it as far as I feel like running, then turn around and come back. Uh-huh. I remember running past it. There's not a lot of signage outside, but there are these doors that open up and these sort of fetching waitresses wearing almost like period clothing that wasn't this period.
Absolutely.
So what was the inspiration for it?
Keith McNally, absolutely.
Oh,
so,
seriously?
Absolutely, that's 100%. Terrible. And that was because during the process of building Le Barricou, I dined at Balthazar, and I'll never forget the first time I went there. That was my first experience with Paris. I hadn't been to Paris. I hadn't been out of the country. You know, I was 20 years old, coming from New Hampshire originally. That was the first time in my life that I had felt that way, walking into a restaurant. You felt like you were somewhere else. Everything affected me, all my emotions, my senses. I noticed the flickering fans, even though it was cold out, but the fans are on to add energy. I noticed the waitresses dressed like French maids. You go down to the bathroom and the stairs look like they've been there for 100 years and worn out.
It almost feels like they're going to fail underneath you, but they've been there forever.
And I think I noticed all of those things right away, and I felt this kind of overwhelming sense of passion that I didn't realize I had. And that's where the seed for Maison Premier was planted in terms of the aesthetic. And so when we were building Maison Premier, it's based on a lot of different things. Originally, we wanted to open a cocktail bar. Then it turned into an oyster bar after traveling to New Orleans. And originally, we were hoping to build kind of this old French kind of cafe, bistro type place that served absinthe and pastis. But I wanted to build it authentically with antiques and everything that was original. And we realized that we weren't going to be able to source French antiques that were affordable, and authentically build out the whole place from start to finish. So we started to change the concept a bit. And through researching, we found some stories about rum runners in New Orleans. And we started just reading about the history books, cocktail books. And a lot of them led to New Orleans. And then once we hit New Orleans, we started reading a little bit more about the New Orleans story, and that's where we discovered Sazeracs, the old-fashioned, the old absinthe house, oysters, Andrew Jackson, the Battle of New Orleans, and all this history started to come together, and we said, wait a minute. So we bought a bunch of books on Amazon in New Orleans, the turn of the century New Orleans, and immediately we knew that was it. We started seeing these black and white photos of the dining room, so the old potbelly stove and the old fans and the waiters with bow ties, and that's where the light bulb turned on, and I bought a plane ticket. The same day, I remember Chris and I were on the phone discussing the concept because we already signed a lease. and the clock was ticking, and I got on an airplane a week later, and I went to New Orleans for a week, 7 days with a camera, and as soon as I hit the French Quarter, it hit me. That same feeling from Balthazar, the history, you could feel the history and the architecture, and immediately I knew that was what Maison Premier was going to be based on, was not that it's a New Orleans bar, but the inspiration of that spirit, trying to find a spirit that's real, and we had to relate to something that was authentic, and that was the history of New Orleans and how the places were built and how they felt. And so I tried to study what that was that back.
I remember the first couple of times I was jogging past, and I would do the double take because, again, are they like French doors that swing open?
The French doors, yeah.
French doors that swing open on the street. They're kind of a green. I'm bad with colors. Are they kind of a green? Or
yeah.
Whatever. I'm lucky I remembered that. And the waitresses were dressed in like period 30s or 40s, like kind of longer black dresses and blousy white tops
exactly.
And hair a certain way. And I could see in a little bit, and it was like a horseshoe. Shoe-shaped bar with just people around it. Early, you open for cocktail hour at four
o'clock every day. Yeah,
and $1 oysters, which is crazy. $1 oysters and this ridiculously well put together wine list where you've got Muscadets going back to the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
All the favorite wines I like, Peak Pools, ridiculous champagne list, just as oysters. So basically, from 4 o'clock till 6:30, 7 o'clock. I mean, they charge $3 to $4 per oyster everywhere else in New York, 24/7, and you're selling them almost at cost.
Absolutely true. So the story is very long, and I don't have time for all of it. But Christoph and myself, when we were developing the concept for Maison Premier, we wanted it to embody all the things that we love about New York. So we said, can we have a wine list like Terroir? Can we have cocktails as good as, say, Death & Company? Yeah. Can we have a wine list like some of the other restaurants that we really like? Can we have the service of, like, La Grenouille in terms of the inspiration, not the actual service? And can we have the ambiance of some of the places we love in New Orleans, Balthazar, Paris, wherever we've been, and can we do it all together in this really small room? And can we have an oyster menu that can rival Grand Central Oyster Bar? Since we didn't have a kitchen, we wanted to have oysters. That was our plan. But we didn't just want to have one or two oysters. That's not how Chris and I are. So, you know, we go extreme in pretty much every category, and that's just the way we operate. And so we decided to go for the largest oyster program in the country and really focus on oysters as that's our game. Like, that's what we're going to do. We're going to know everything about it. We're going to build the relationships. We're going to find the best deals, and we're going to get the freshest oysters possible. And so that was our idea, but we didn't actually think it was going to be possible, all of those things. And I think in some way we were able to accomplish a lot of those different things, and I think people are now starting to realize that we've done that after a couple years. It's taken some time.
Well, are you up for a beard?
Yeah, yesterday we were nominated for a James Beard Award.
Thank you very much.
Always on the fence about the beards, but I know when it's a great thing, and it's one of those notches on your belt. It is a great thing. It never hurts. I opened the show by talking about what I'm dubbing the Church of Brooklyn movement, which is great. I mean, I think that I remember when Alan Harding opened Patois on Smith Street a million years ago, or more like 15.
Yeah,
and it was simply rent. It was just like he found a place for $1,000, and he's like, dude, if it fails, I'll live in it for $1,000. I don't care. And one by one, Saul, the grocery, that whole Carter opened up. And then you began to see this exodus of not just talented chefs leaving Manhattan for more affordable rents, but a lot of the food writers and bloggers were already living in Brooklyn because it was cheaper. So Brooklyn became this kind of incubator for a young talent pool, both on the kitchen side, on the artisanal ingredient side, and on the patronage side, as it grew. I mean, Williamsburg was sort of reinvented in the last 15 years. And it is fervent and evangelical and to some extent exclusive. And one of my big criticisms of it has always been when I would peel back the onion of these restaurants, a lot of them seem to be a couple of chefs that sort of blew up with a pop-up somewhere or were sous or somewhere who got a couple of backers and they said, let's do a spot. We found a spot. And I'm a chef, so I know what this is like. And they just said, fuck the front of the house. I'll have a really cool menu and they'll come because the food's going to be good. And that's what works. And so my complaint about so much of what's happening in Brooklyn now is it's not hospitality anymore. It's like chefs, masturbatory, ego-driven. It's my place. I'm a god. Bow down to me. This is the food. This is the menu. If you don't like it, don't come back. You guys have bucked that trend. And if you don't mind, can I address this to Ben, because he's your guy. Talk about the front of the house, because you guys just nail it. I mean, you first of all, you're sitting here today in a radio interview. I know you came from work, but you've got like custom-made suits on. You're wearing a bow tie. You've got a vest on with like a half Windsor. This is how you guys dress all the time. You got shit in your hair. You look like 1930s movie stars. But that sets a tone for people walking in. So it's not beards and beanies and untucked flannels and here's your menu, whatever. It's, hey, welcome to our restaurant.
And one of the reasons why it feels so real when you come to Maison Premier is because it is real. It's not a costume. You know, this isn't like a uniform that, you know, you get when you walk in the door and you get a job there. It's a lifestyle. Most of us dress this way when we leave work on our days off. So I think that's also something that plays a big role into why it's so successful, is because everyone's passionate about it, because that's how they really feel. That's how they believe in handmade American suits and vintage bow ties.
And we really have to set the standards, I feel like, as you know, as managers, as owners, we kind of show the staff what we're doing, and we live it, and we show them, you know, I polish my shoes every day before I come to work. And I expect them to do the same thing.
And I think, you know, part of the reason why Ben is here is one of the things that we looked at when we were developing Maison Premier was we wanted to stand out in each category. We wanted to stand out not just because we're competitive, but we wanted to stand out because we wanted to change the perspective that people have on restaurants. And we've always kind of been against what Williamsburg has always been known for, not because we don't like it, because we do. We've been in the neighborhood for 10 years, but because we don't like that people in the city or people from overseas or tourists, they have this, you know, preconcepted idea of what it is, you know. And so for us, I think with Maison Premier, we hired Ben Crispin, who is a service director. And our goal for, you know, his position was, can we create a refined service that's friendly and approachable and hospitable? Can people come in and have dollar oysters, but also have a pint of beer if they want? They can walk in a t-shirt.
And you also, we should add to this, you suit. Also have a full-on kitchen now. Now yeah. you've put that in the basement now. You were able to do that.
Yeah.
You've got a chef who I recognize. She worked for one of my old friends at Restaurant 81, Ed Brown. I know she's got chops. So you've got a full-on menu. So this isn't just a place for people listening that might want to come. Yeah, you've got oysters for happy hour, but if you want to come at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and have a full-on meal, the food's great.
What Josh was saying, it's completely true. You can come in for a pint of beer and leave, or you can come for a tasting menu and spend 3 hours eating, you know.
And your dining room in the back, that garden room, I know it's been a nasty winter, but once spring sets in, you've got this beautiful dining room that, I mean, again, that's like, you know, it's like, in as much as Balthazar, and as much as I think restaurants should be transformative, I mean, it's not just here's your burger, fuck you.
Yeah.
It has to speak to you in some other way. And it's called the hospitality business for a reason. I started at 13. That's all I've ever done is this business, and you know that's you've nailed it, and it's transformative. So you go into your restaurant in the spring, summer, fall, in that back room, it's just, what is it, wisteria? What's all that stuff growing everywhere?
We have a landscaper come, and we spend thousands of dollars every spring. Unfortunately, most of the plants are tropical because it was based on the Garden District. I toured the Garden District in New Orleans, and of course, most of the plants are tropical because of the tropical climate. And so, unfortunately, we lose the vast majority of it. But I think there's over 75 varieties of different plants and herbs. So we use a lot of the herbs that were back there we use for cooking, but there is definitely wisteria is the main vine. There's all types of ivy and ferns and palms and all different geraniums, but it's beautiful. And the garden was originally an empty pit.
It's sunlit too. You've got that wonderful afternoon light. It is like the place. It's like
talking
about a date place. Talk about a place to fall in love. Yeah. I mean, if that doesn't get you moving back there, just check your pulse and go to the doctor quickly.
There's an oyster bar in the garden and a bar in the garden.
Correct. You got a bar back there too.
Yeah.
It's not a service bar. It's the bar.
Yeah.
And then the kitchen's right downstairs from that side. It's great. Let me just reintroduce you if someone tunes in late. I don't know if you can on internet radio, but I'm an old radio guy. My guests are Ben Crispin, who runs the front of the house at Maison Premier, and Josh Boissy, who's one of the two owners. It's really one of my favorite restaurants in Brooklyn. Not that I get across the bridge enough. I just, for whatever reason, I'm a Manhattanite. Sorry, boys. But I will. One of these days. When it warms up again, I'll get the bicycle out. And how, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you guys now?
Well, I'm going to be 28 in June.
I'm 33.
So a couple of weeks ago, I was filming another restaurant that's not a new restaurant, Bethany, up 57th Street.
The best meal I had last year.
Thank you.
Incredible.
I went there because I filmed there because I had three meals there last year, one lunch and two dinners. And I remember every course I had from every meal, and it was like the best lobster I had, the best shrimp, and it was like among my five or six best meals all year long.
The foie gras.
Foie gras was insane. Wine list is crazy. Service was great. And these are two guys. So it's funny. So the chef, Eamon's 28. And Bryce is 32.
Right.
So exactly the same. So you guys are not even out of your freaking 20s yet, and you've just hit this stride. Now, they've got 3 stars in the Times. Huge review. Really helped them, I think, get over the fence, because 57th and 6th isn't exactly a – don't get me started. I work out at the New York Athletic Club every day for 25 years. I know the neighborhood like the back of my hand. I used to be the chef of the Ritz-Carlton around the corner. You know, it's an old folks' neighborhood up there, and it's a businessman's neighborhood. It's not – you're not south of 14th Street. You're not East Village, West Village, Lower East Side. It's a different crowd up there. They needed that review. But it's interesting because those are Brooklyn guys who are opening up in Manhattan, and I know of at least five or six more projects that I heard of in the last couple of weeks got stalled in Brooklyn because of expense. Because you guys are like the borough's the victim of its own success. Once landlords got the idea, wait a minute, there are these restaurants coming, we could quadruple we'll ask whatever the hell we want. I think restaurateurs have looked at parts of Brooklyn now and said, I'm not so sure it's viable. I know of at least five projects, because those guys both live in Brooklyn too, and they're working in Manhattan now, that sort of canceled their Brooklyn projects to come back to the Lower East Side or to the East Village.
Absolutely true, and I think our block is at a perfect case and example for this. The spaces that are right next to Maison Premier opened up recently. The building was purchased, and they're asking $200 a square foot.
That's prime.
You're $15,000 for a 1,000 square foot restaurant. And on the corner, they're asking $25,000. And I just don't, I have no idea how that's even possible. And so we started looking in the city just out of curiosity to compare. And there's places, you know, you could find spaces in Tribeca that were beautiful, tall ceilings, cast iron storefronts for $70 a square foot. So it's exactly true. People think that Brooklyn's cheap and Brooklyn's the place to be, but Brooklyn has changed dramatically, especially Williamsburg in particular. Yep. It's more expensive, I think, for residential and for commercial spaces right now than most parts of the city.
It's a fact. It's crazy.
It's a fact.
People are selling their New York City penthouses and buying Williamsburg penthouses.
And from a business perspective, because we have two restaurants in the neighborhood, and we have for one of them for 7 years now, so we've learned a lot about the demographics of how business work, and they're demanding these rents, but the check average in Brooklyn is very different than the city and the clientele base.
Correct.
And I love Brooklyn. I love the people of Brooklyn. I'm a resident of Brooklyn, but they don't spend nearly as much money as the people in the city that are making several hundred thousand dollars a year, or that are have expense accounts or company dinners. For instance, the holiday time in the restaurant industry in the city is just bonkers. I remember calling to book a party for our managers to have a staff dinner. And every restaurant was booked.
Yeah.
Corporate parties at every single place I booked.
And Q4 in Manhattan in
Brooklyn,
a good year.
Zero.
Insane.
At our place, there's zero company parties. It's just a very different, it's a very different demographic to do business in. I think you can do well as a neighborhood place. You can do well as a destination, but you're not hitting those checks, and you're not selling those bottles of wine that you would if you were in the city.
Yeah, those
and so,
prize bottles. Working at Oceana for so long, we had back in the day one of the craziest white Burgundy lists in the city, and we were routinely selling those really big high-end bottles, like every day, opening up amazing bottles of wine that I could sit on our list for years and years and years.
Yeah.
We're also learning
that there are limitations. I think in our minds, we've been inspired by these great hotels and restaurants from New Orleans and Paris and New York City, and we wanted to bring all of that to Brooklyn. We wanted to be the first to serve champagne, which we have two different – we have rosé champagne by the glass, which we lose a ton of money on, and regular champagne, and wine list with 200 bottles. But we're realizing, with our truffles and our caviar and our champagne by the glass, that no matter how hard we want to serve – it the same way that the restaurants in the city, no matter how hard we try, no matter how low we mark it down, no matter what we do to serve it, it's just not moving the way it would if you're in the city. And that's very frustrating that no matter what you do, no matter how you serve it, whether it's the beautiful trays and the presentation from the staff and everything's choreographed and the cost of it is much lower than it would be in the city, it still is just something that we struggle with. And I think that's the reality of doing business in Brooklyn.
Well, I mentioned at the outset, and again, I am a fan. I mean, there's nothing worse than old people that are bemoaning change, in my opinion. Because even though I'm an old guy now, I still have the head of an 18-year-old, I think, sometimes. But, and it was nothing worse than a kid growing up and listening to old people, rock and roll or the blues. Or it was all better in the 50s. It's bullshit. The scene in Brooklyn's great, but I do think it's kind of like if I was looking at it as like dog years or something, it's like a teenage movement right now. It has a ton of energy. It's stoked about itself. It's kind of F-U-ing to everybody else. We're here. We got it. This is our scene. But at the same time, it needs to mature. It probably needs 5, 10, maybe 15 years, maybe for the demographics to rise, maybe for the income to match the expectations, so that at some point you'll probably see what you're talking about, but that year is going to be 2025 or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know how long it's going to be, but I know it's probably not going to be anytime soon. And even, like I said, we've been in the business in the neighborhood for 7 years, and we haven't seen a big change at all in terms of the check averages.
Well, you've been super successful. Thanks for coming on the show. And again, congratulations on the beard. Good luck with that. It's a great restaurant. And
Thank you.
I mean, again, you're on the show for a couple of reasons, and not the least of which is I think that what you've exhibited that I've seen more than any other restaurant on that side of the East River is you really get the hospitality side. It's like great. It's dope. It's like you're a full-on kind of, I don't want to say world-class to be pretentious, but you're a restaurant that's really just saying, we're going to jump as high as it takes to get there, and there is no limit. So whether it's bespoke ties, shoe shines, hair product, a great sense of front of the house, good food, the whole thing, you've put it together. Great, great, great job.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, guys. My guests have been Ben Crispin, who's the maitre d', and they should have maitre d', like if you do a Wikipedia, they should have like your picture there at some point, with the glasses and the hair and the mustache.
Thank you.
And Josh Bossy, one of the two owners of Maison Premier, which is apparently it's on the south side of Williamsburg. I wouldn't know. Hey, I just jog through and bike through once in a while. But thanks for coming on. Keep up the great work. And next week, folks, we've got a great show. I'll have Lauren DeStefano, who's the recently appointed head chef at Marea, which is great. So we're going to talk about women in this industry and women sort of breaking that glass ceiling. I think it's more common than you think. We're going to talk about that. We're going to have her come in from Marea, and then we're going to have another female chef who is the chef at Red Gravy, which I think is in Park Slope. You tell me when I get there, but it's a great, great little restaurant. So next week, the entire 1 hour will be devoted to women in this industry with two chefs who are walking the walk and talking the talk. That's next week on Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back next week with that. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.